The Committee on Judiciary and Public Safety will come to order. For the purposes of record, the date is January 18th, 2011. Members, the agenda today, we will be hearing from the Department of Corrections, Civil Legal Services, and Sentencing Guidelines Commission. It's important to understand not only their work, but some of the difficulties that they have in an era of diminishing resources. As you know, or maybe you don't know, anytime we adjust the sentencing guidelines or the consequences to a crime or add a new crime onto our statute books, it definitely is something that we like to go home and pound our chest on when we go back home, but these people are the ones that are going to have the consequences of dealing with that, as well as the budget that we sometimes advance and make difficult in times of limited resources. To begin, we'll be having Chris Bray from the Department of Corrections, acting commissioner there. And as she approaches, welcome.
Thank you.
And Ms. Bray, who will you be having today with you?
With me today is Deputy Commissioner David Crist, who oversees the facilities, and Assistant Commissioner Lisa Ogroski, who oversees our Operations Support Division.
All right. For our members, I think what we should do in order of time, let's limit our questions until after these three presenters are finished, and then we'll open it for questions before we move on to the next segment. Ms. Crist, or Ms. Bray.
Thank you. Mr. Chair, members, I am acting commissioner, but I'm also the deputy commissioner of the Community Service Division. Thank you very much for the opportunity to present to you. We have 30 minutes, and so we're going to give you just the big, broad picture. We welcome your questions, and if you're interested in any more follow-up that helps you to see what we do and how we do it, like tours of the facilities or going around with agents or anything like that, we're very happy to accommodate. Okay. The Department of Corrections contributes to a safer Minnesota by focusing on public safety, and specifically, we lock up the state's most serious and dangerous offenders. We provide probation and parole supervision to offenders in the community, and we provide opportunities to offenders for positive change. Minnesota is committed to serving offenders at the local level whenever possible and reserving state beds for the most serious and chronic offenders, and you can see that we're the 49th lowest in our incarceration rate per capita. The 2008 Pew report, it's called One in 100 Behind Bars in America, recommends greater use of community supervision for lower risk offenders. DOC is the third largest cabinet agency, and I don't know that I need to read through all these stats for you, but we wanted to give you the big picture, the number of employees, our total budget for fiscal year 12-13, the number of inmates. About 6.5% of those 9,600 adults are females. We serve in 1 year 16,500 offenders from intake through release. We have 10 facilities, 8 adult, 2 juvenile, and we maintain 6 million square feet of buildings. DOC Field Services supervises over 20,000 offenders, and we have 14 district offices spread all around the state. This is just a brief snapshot of our budget. Institutions make up 70% of our budget. Community services makes up 25% of the budget. But note, 65% of that 25% is passed through money. And then operations support makes up 5% of our budget. With that, I'd like to turn it over to Deputy Commissioner David Crist.
Mr. Crist.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, my name is David Crist. I'm the Deputy Commissioner for the Facilities Division. The slide before you shows the geographical distribution of our facilities across the state. 84% of the staff in the department work in the prisons. There's 8 adult facilities, 2 juvenile facilities, and Deputy Commissioner Bray gave the breakdown of the offenders in our facilities. One of the main challenges that we've got in facilities these days is idleness. What to do with offenders? They need to have something to keep them busy, because when they don't, they misbehave, and when they misbehave, they put the safety and security of staff and other offenders at risk. On the plus side, however, we do a very good job of keeping offenders in prisons where they're supposed to be. For the past several years, we've had 0 escapes, and I can't even really remember a serious escape attempt in any of our facilities recently. The facilities are divided into 5 different custody levels. Level 5 is maximum security, and Oak Park Heights is the one facility in that category. Level 4 is at Rush City, Stillwater, and St. Cloud, which is our intake facility. Any adult male offender who's committed by a judge goes from the county jail to St. Cloud, where they're evaluated and assessed. And I'll talk about that in a little bit here. Level 3 facilities, medium custody, we call it, are at Lino Lakes, Moose Lake, and Faribault. Faribault also has a level 2 minimum security unit. And we have level 1 minimum security units at Stillwater, Red Wing, Lino Lakes, and then the challenge incarceration programs at Willow River and Togo. As Commissioner Bray mentioned, one of our tasks in the facilities division is to maintain 6 million square feet in these aging facilities. 6 million square feet is 6 target fields, just to put that into some context for folks. We've got a lot of roofs that need to be replaced, and when they start to leak, you got to fix them. We've had 2 instances of that in the past year. We've got 10 generators that need a slight upgrade to them in order to meet emissions standards that are coming up. We've got to deal with Xcel Energy that we run our generators during the summer when they're hitting peak cooling season, so that they can shed some of the load. And as long as we do that, we get a deal on our electrical rates. So in order to continue to do that, we've got to upgrade these generators. And then in the past couple of years, the elevator codes have been changed, and we've got to upgrade our elevators to bring them into safety codes as well. We've got an objective process that we use to decide where we're going to put our money. It's based on security, safety, energy and resource efficiencies, cost of deferring maintenance on our facilities, and also the age of assets. So we try to take a very deliberate and objective process toward where we're going to spend our money on our infrastructure. The projections for prison populations always keep us on our toes. Right now, we're in a good spot. We don't have any offenders housed outside of our own correctional facilities. We did have offenders until recently in county jails, and until about this time last year, when the Prairie Correctional Facility, a private prison run by CCA, closed, we had offenders out there. But for the foreseeable future, we're not going to need to add more bed space for adult males, and at least until after 2016, we should probably assess the female population in 2014 and take a look at that. But if laws stay the same in terms of who goes to prison, we're in pretty good shape for the foreseeable future. So who do we have in prison right now? Well, it's convicted felony offenders. they've got to have at least a year sentenced from the court before they come to us. And they come to us with an average of 7 prior convictions, 3 of those on average felony convictions. The inmate offense profile is about 51% of our offenders are person offenders. And notable in that group is that 17% approximately are sex offenders, 14% have committed some level of homicide, 12% have committed some level of assault in that group. Healthcare provides challenges to us as well. As we all know, healthcare is very expensive. An example, one case of congestive heart failure cost us $344,000 to treat. Offenders, based on case law, based on constitutional claims, offenders are entitled to a minimal level of health care. We've got a contract with a private health care company, and through utilization reviews, close attention to formularies, prescription formularies, they've done a lot to keep our health care costs in check. We provide treatment programs for offenders who are chemically dependent and who are sex offenders. There's about 1,800 offenders in our department who have been assessed with some need for sex offender treatment. We've got about 350 beds to treat those offenders in our facilities. About 2,900 offenders have been assessed as needing some degree of chemical dependency treatment. And we've got about 800 beds to treat those offenders in our facilities. So the challenge that we've got is how to get as many people into treatment as we can possibly get, because one of the successes we know in this area is that treatment does reduce recidivism. When people aren't coming back to prison, that's because they're not committing more crimes, and if they're not committing more crimes, public safety is enhanced. We also operate education programs in our facilities. 32% of the offenders who come to us don't have a high school diploma or a GED. On the plus side, we're able to graduate about 534 offenders on an annual basis, getting them that GED or that high school diploma. We are presently studying recidivism as it relates to education in our facilities, but there's a national study that came out several years ago now that looked at 3 states, 3,000 inmates, including 1,000 from Minnesota, and found that participation in education programs reduced recidivism by 29%. Other inmates in our facilities have different kinds of work assignments. They might do facility maintenance. They might work in the food service. Some at our minimum security units will go out into the community and do work projects, clearing brush, maintaining parks. When we get into the flood season, those guys spend an awful lot of time filling sandbags. And several years ago, they actually built one of the dikes downtown in Stillwater that helped save the downtown area from flooding. They also work in our prison industries program, which is a self-sufficient program based on the product that they sell and the money they earn from that. They do metal products, metal fabrication, license plates. They do assembly work. They make seating for meeting rooms, libraries, and schools. They do some printing. They put together custodial products, soups and soaps rather, and cleaning supplies. They do outdoor recreation equipment such as the piers and docks that you see on many of the DNR sites around the state. And they build detention furniture that we use in our facilities and sell to jails and other systems around the country. offenders employed in these jobs start earning 25 cents an hour, and they, by statute, then some of that money comes back for court-ordered restitution, dependent support, and aid to victims of crimes. Over $380,000 for restitution, $247,000 for dependent support, and $269,000 for aid to victims of crime. One of the most important things we do in the Department of Corrections, not just the Facilities Division, is to prepare offenders for their release from prison. Since 1980, Minnesota has had a determinant sentencing process. So by statute, offenders serve 2/3 of their time in prison and 1/3 of their time out on the streets. 95% of offenders who enter prison in Minnesota are someday released from prison. To that end, to serve that end, we do pre-release programming in our prisons where we concentrate on helping offenders line up jobs, medical, psychological care, treatment and aftercare services when they're released, housing, and to connect them with a faith community if that's a need for a particular individual. And with that, I'll ask Commissioner Bray to speak more about the community-based corrections programs.
Commissioner Bray.
The Department of Corrections provides a variety of court-ordered services in conjunction with the state's other two community corrections delivery systems. So we operate in a three delivery system model, and I thought I should probably start with that. The Department of Corrections field services provides supervision to felons, misdemeanants, and juveniles in 28 counties. We provide adult felon supervision in 55 counties, those 28 plus 27 additional. We provide intensive supervised release supervision in 75 counties, and supervision in 82 counties to challenge incarceration program releases. Community Correction Act counties operate under the Community Corrections Act. They provide supervision to all adult felon misdemeanants and juveniles. They're organized into 17 jurisdictions comprised of 32 counties. Each jurisdiction receives a subsidy through the community service unit. And then the county probation officer counties operate under county judges. They provide supervision to all juvenile and adult misdemeanants in 27 counties. The DOC provides the felony supervision in those 27 counties. Each county probation officer county receives up to 50% of reimbursement for their probation officer's salary, and that reimbursement comes through the community service unit. They currently receive about 36% of that reimbursement. So together, these three entities supervise 138,000 offenders in Minnesota. I thought I would just show you some statewide numbers now, not just DOC. Offenders on probation, remember, are court-ordered to supervision in the community versus being sentenced to prison. Offenders on supervised release are offenders coming out of prison. And as Mr. Chris said, two-thirds of offenders serve two-thirds of their sentence in prison and one-third in the community under supervision. So we used to call supervised release parole. We just don't call it that anymore. More offenders on supervision, there are more offenders on supervision in the community than many other states, but that allows Minnesota to use prison beds for the more serious offenders, and it's an efficient use of our resources. People on probation have not been sentenced to prison, and this is just a snapshot of what that looks like in the state of Minnesota. Again, 132,000 on probation statewide, not just with the Department of Corrections. DOC supervises about 18,500 of those probationers. So you can see from the slide the profile. And then I thought it would be important to show you the outcome from the supervision of those probation officers. This is a statewide outcome. It's not just the Department of Corrections Field Services. 85% of probationers do not return on probation or commit a new felony offense within 3 years of being discharged. And we look 3 years out because that's where recidivism tends to plateau. If we just looked 1 year out, as you can see, it would look much better. 2 years out, a little bit lower, et cetera. 3 years is a pretty good indicator. So now I'd like to shift and talk about the Community Services Division. Mr. Chris talked about offenders while they're incarcerated and getting them ready for release. We work very closely with the Facility Division in our efforts around reentry. We have a very small reentry unit, and their job is to really sharpen our department focus so that everything we do is about successful reentry. It's not soft on crime, it's smart on crime. It's all about trying to reduce recidivism and enhance public safety. We started with a pilot project with a very rigorous research component, and we learned that when we do everything right, starting with the day the offender walks in the door, that we're able to reduce reoffending anywhere from 40 to 56% compared to a similar group who wasn't in our pilot project. So right now we're expanding beyond that pilot project and working on what are we going to do to make this a statewide initiative. We have help from the National Institute of Corrections, and we're implementing what we and they call the transition from prison to community model. That's one of our successes. We also have Second Chance Act grants from the federal government related to reentry. In talking about field services, that's where we have some of the challenges. And one large challenge is increasing caseload sizes, particularly in the intensive supervised release unit, which I'll talk about in a minute. But the other challenge is finding suitable housing for especially level three, level two, and level three sex offenders. Our field services unit does more than just supervision in the community. They oversee the Interstate Compact, which regulates the movement of offenders in and out of the state. They oversee the Sentencing to Service Program and the Institution and Community Work Group programs. Another unit in the Community Service Division is our Grants and Subsidy Unit, which administers and monitors over 360 grants, subsidies, and contracts out to counties and nonprofits. The Inspection and Enforcement Unit licenses and inspects 237 adult and juvenile correctional facilities. That includes jails. It also includes halfway houses, some residential services, and juvenile facilities out of state where Minnesota sends juvenile delinquents. And finally, we have a Community Notification and Risk Assessment Unit, which assigns risk levels to predatory offenders for the purposes of community notification. We assist law enforcement with those meetings and with community education meetings. We maintain the Level 3 website. In 1 year, we conduct approximately 800 sex offender risk assessments and civil commitment reviews. I want to flip back now for just a minute and talk about DOC field services. When we're supervising offenders released from prison in the community, we have a continuum of supervision levels. Supervised release is the traditional level. Intensive supervised release is for level two and three and predatory offenders that are very, very high risk. By statute, those caseloads are two agents per 30 offenders. We use a broad range of supervision to monitor those offenders, including house arrest, electronic home monitoring, 24/7 random visits, and UAs. One more success I want to talk about, or one more way that we do business, and not just DOC Field Services, but it's used throughout the state, and that is we use evidence-based practices in our supervision strategies with offenders. Offenders are assessed using a validated, reliable risk assessment tool, and then they're placed on a continuum of supervision. This allows us to target our resources to the higher risk offenders and to target those interventions to address the behaviors that lead to their criminal behavior. And then finally, I thought I would mention, again, I think it's a success, our offender house building program. This is an example of using our offender resources to benefit the community. It started in 1998 with a $700,000 revolving fund to build affordable housing for low-income families, and the fund is replenished when the homes sell. The offenders are a select group of minimum security inmates who are within the last 24 months of their incarceration. One project that I think is worth highlighting, especially since the housing boom has sort of dissipated, is the project that we just completed in Duluth to provide housing for veterans and their families. And I would just ask you to take a look at the before and after pictures, because if you ever are in Duluth and you go look at this and you look inside, you would be amazed at what a beautiful place it's become. And DOC had a small part in that. We provided some of the labor. With that, I would stop and turn it over to Assistant Commissioner Obrasky.
Assistant Commissioner Cornelius, welcome.
Good afternoon. Thank you. For the record, my name is Assistant Commissioner Lisa Obrasky, and I'm responsible for the Operations Support Division of the Department of Corrections, which actually I like to call the grease or the glue that holds the agency together. This division is responsible for all the financial transactions, all the budgeting, fiscal notes. They're responsible for hiring all of our staff, making sure we're meeting our diversity goals, making sure people get their training. We have our policy and legal department, which is responsible for our litigation management, sentence administration. They're also our hearings and release unit. We have victim assistance and restorative justice in this division. They are responsible for victim notification. They also do victim and offender dialogues. We also have our information technology unit. And this group of people just doesn't provide help desk support. They do application development. They do programming. And we all provide services not just to the Department of Corrections, but also to different law enforcement agencies and the counties. Our biggest challenge right now is trying to maintain our level of service in regards to training and information technology, as we have reduced resources in this division. One of our big successes I'd like to talk about is our use of continuous improvement methods to streamline victim notification. We use continuous improvement throughout our organization, but we partnered with the Department of Public Safety and received grant funding to automate the victim notification process. We now have a new system that was just rolled out called Minnesota Choice, and so victims now can find out online where offenders are, and they can also provide us with input on different types of activities they might like to see the offender do upon reentry that we can then consider. I just want to show you a couple of examples of some of the work our IT unit does. We have a public website that provides an offender locator, so anybody can go online and find out where an offender is located and the public data regarding his or her offense. We also have the DOC Level 3 website, which I know is used quite frequently. This is, again, a public tool for people to find out if they have Level 3 sex offenders living in their neighborhoods. We also have our fugitive page, and hopefully this is used so people can help us locate fugitives that might be out there that we need to apprehend. There's a law enforcement viewer, which by statute is only used by certain law enforcement agencies. But this is one of the things where we partner with law enforcement to help everyone in the criminal justice system. We also have the statewide supervision system, which is used by probation agents across the state in all three delivery systems. We have a sentencing guidelines worksheet. This helps people figure out what the guidelines will read on specific cases. We also have an offender risk assessment tool. It allows probation agents to use a validated offender risk assessment instrument to ensure that their programming and treatment resources are accurately and effectively allocated, so we make sure we have good supervision discussions. I'm going to briefly touch on operational reductions, and I want to say up front that these are very specific programmatic or operational reductions. In 2002 and 2003, we had a self-imposed per diem reduction plan. We had looked at all of our operations and determined that there was over 200 positions that we could cut, and we figured out how to add 500 beds to our system without having capital costs. There were reductions in every single division. In the 2004 and 5 biennium, there was a reduction of $36.7 million. We did this with some double bunking, again, reductions in each division, and then we eliminated 80 positions at that time. During this time, part of that cut was the out years of the per diem reduction plan had bigger tails on it. So they were bigger tails because it was a five-year plan. In the 2006 and 2007 biennium, we took reductions of $24.1 million. There again, more double bunking. We had some unrealized bed savings from conditional releases. There was a cut of $657,000 on professional technical contracts in the 08-09 biennium, and in 2010 and 11, we took $19.1 million in reductions overall in all divisions, and there's also a transfer next year coming up that we have to pay DHS for some services they are providing for the Department of Corrections. With this said, I will also point out that our budget has remained relatively flat. So as you look at these reductions, you would think our budget has decreased that amount. However, as prison population increases, we are given a base adjustment for those new prisoners. Also, the same will be said if we have lower prisoner projections, our budget will be cut. And as we go into this next biennium, you will see that there is a cut in our budget because of the reduction in the number of offenders that we will have. So our budget does look like it has remained relatively flat. So in essence, we've kind of absorbed all the new offenders with a flat budget. We do have some unique budget challenges. We do not have any ability to control admissions. When an offender is brought to St. Cloud or to Shakopee, we don't get to say, sorry, we're full at the end, and send them away. We have to accept all admissions. We are largely state-funded. We do not have much money coming in from other resources besides the state's general fund. And we have few fine or fee mechanisms. We do charge offenders a health care copayment fee when they go to the clinic within the prison, and we do have some other internal fees, but inmates don't have a lot of money, and so it's difficult to try to charge them. Overall, our vision is to focus on reducing risk. We want to contribute to a safer Minnesota by providing core correctional care, changing offender behavior, holding offenders accountable, and restoring justice for victims.
Mr. Chair, members, that concludes our presentation.
We'll open for questions. Senator Marty.
Mr. Chair, I had two questions, one of which was on the supervised release page. You talk about two agents per 30 offenders for intensive supervised release. What's the current caseload for the regular supervised release? What's average?
Within the DOC, we probably average 65 to 70 offenders on a traditional caseload, and it would vary depending on the other counties.
The community correction county is about the same?
Correct.
I'm
sorry. I'm not sure what it is for the other, for example, for Community Correction Act counties. I would guess it's right around there, but I really don't know.
And, Mr. Chairman, the other question was just a confusion on my part. I'm not sure if this is the right reading of it. But one of the pages you talk about, there were 7,700 inmates released in last year. And then the number of people on supervised release on your other pie chart was only 5,400. Is that because the 5,400, is it any given the snapshot in time, and since most of the supervised releases, I gather, less than a year then?
Mr. Chair, Senator, that's correct. The 5,000 number, I believe it was December 31st of the end of the year, so that was a snapshot.
Snapshot, not the year.
The larger total number was the number that goes through per year.
Thank you.
Sarah Ortman.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. A question about the pilot program with the early release with intensive supervision. Is that not set to expire this year without new legislation? Is that what I understood to be true?
Commissioner Bray.
Mr. Chair, Senator, I think, are you talking about the, we call it AmCorp, the reentry pilot project I spoke about?
Senator Ortman.
It was a little different than that. It was an increase in good time credit for going through treatment successfully and planning reentry. There was a pilot program that we passed as a legislature a couple of years ago, and I'm just wondering what's the status of that and when do we need to revisit that again in order to continue it or expand it?
Deputy Commissioner Crist.
Mr. Chairman, Senator Ortman, I think you're referring to what's called the conditional release program. And the sunset on that was extended in the last session, I believe, and I think it needs to be readdressed in this session. But we can find out for sure and get back to you on that.
Sir Ortman.
And Mr. Chair, if you would please, I'm very interested in the success rate, or it may only be by analogy, there may only be a few. I don't remember how many cases there were. It was a great big huge population I know that was affected, but it would be useful to know the success rate and how well these folks have been doing or not doing.
Commissioner.
Mr. Right. Chair, Senator, I can tell you I think currently we may have just one person in that program. We lost the positions that we had for it. However, the reason we don't use that program as much is because we increased the number of offenders going into the challenge incarceration program. And so from our point of view, we only had so many offenders that were eligible for early release. But we do have a report that dates back a couple years that provides outcome information.
Senator Ortman.
And, Mr. Chair, would that be in all of those related programs? Because I think we should just look at all of those similar programs. Let's make sure we're heading in the right direction, that we have enough of that programming for the right folks that want to do it.
Sarah Goodwin.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Commissioner Bray, I see in your operational reductions here, for 08-09, you have 657,000 reduction in PT contracts. I was wondering if those were contracts that had already expired or if those were purposeful cancellations because of funding. That would be good to know.
Mr. Chair, Senator Goodwin. Actually, it was an overall statewide cut to professional technical contracts, and we took the cut in our budget. We didn't necessarily reduce a specific professional technical contract. Our agency uses two very large ones, and it's for our health care for our offenders, and it's also to provide food service. So we took the hit in our budget. We did not necessarily cut. That was the reason for it at a state level. We didn't necessarily cut those contracts.
Oh,
Senator Goodwin.
Mr. Chair, thank you. Commissioner, Assistant Commissioner. So actually, you didn't reduce the funding by that. You reduced other parts of your budget by that much rather than, that's kind of a problem, I think. But can you tell me what your total PT contracts are for this biennium?
Commissioner,
the total amount
Russell.
That you actually have in spending in already signed contracts and so forth.
Mr. Chair, Senator Goodwin, I'd be happy to get back to you. I don't have that number off the top of my head. I do know our health care contract is around $25 million. So we'll get back to you with that number.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you. Senator Latz.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I had a question about the second page of the presentation dealing with the proportion of the population that is incarcerated. Can you, for the Minnesota line, can you help me explain the or understand the connection between the state population, the prison population, and the incarceration rate? Because it looks like there are other states with almost identical prison populations that have much higher, or almost identical state populations that have much higher prison populations, but much lower incarceration rates.
Mm-hmm. What's the ranking? The ranking of states.
Are these the rankings?
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Mr. Chairman, not Senator Latz, those...
Deputy Commissioner Crist.
The way I read the chart is that Minnesota, with a similar state population, has a prison population that's about a third of those other states, and that Minnesota is the second lowest in the country in incarceration rate, when those other states are much, much higher in incarceration rates, given a similar general population.
So, Mr. Chairman.
Senator Latz.
Commissioner, so what the column incarceration rate is the state ranking?
It's the state ranking among all states in the country, Mr. Chair and Senator Latz.
Okay. I also,
Senator Latz.
If I may, Mr. Chairman, had a question relating to chemical dependency treatment and psychotropic medications. I think here you said there was 22% of the population was on psychotropic medications. Or at least of the male population, and it was like 68%. Here we go on adult females on psychotropic medications. My question has to do with what happens when they are released. Are they getting any more significant psychiatric treatment while they are in custody? And what happens when they are released? How is that health care planned for or provided for? And in a related matter, the chemical dependency treatment, it looks like you only have enough beds to give treatment to around 28, a little less than 28% of those who are assessed as specifically needing chemical dependency treatment. And my guess is most of their crimes were somehow connected to chemical use as well, since probably 70-80% or more of criminal activity is related to either alcohol or drugs. Are we essentially warehousing two-thirds of those who have chemical dependency problems and are receiving no treatment during their years in prison?
Mr. Chairman,
Commissioner
Senator
Crist.
Latz, let me take the second question first. When offenders are admitted to either Shakopee or to St. Cloud, we do, among other things, a chemical dependency assessment. We find often that there's two levels of chemical use need. There's a level that we call dependency. That's the true addiction versus abusive use of chemicals, which tends to get a lot of people in trouble. When they drink or use drugs, they make bad decisions. They get in trouble. A lot of them come to prison. Addicted individuals are a different breed of cat, because it's a true addiction. We look at those offenders and we prioritize who ought to be in treatment while they are in prison. And we try to do our best to get those addicted individuals into prison and to get them treatment. And we've got good outcomes on that. Those individuals that go through primary treatment in our facilities reduce their rate of reincarceration by about 30%. So that works. We do offer other opportunities for those offenders that can't be in residential therapeutic community in our facilities. There are AA programs, NA, Narcotics Anonymous programs that they can attend while they are incarcerated, and we do make them address their chemical abusiveness or chemical dependency through aftercare programs when they're released, or as a condition of their release that they attend some sort of program. So we're trying to use the limited resources that we've got to the best of the ability that we have As a matter of fact, we did recently, in the last year or so, get a federal grant to add about 100 chemical dependency beds at our Faribault facility. So we're always looking for those opportunities, and we're always looking for ways to get more people into treatment. On the on the question regarding the psychotropic drugs, we incarcerate many fewer females than we do males, and so it takes a longer time for females to reach the point where they're going to come to prison, and they have the most troubles in their lives. They've been victims of abuse or domestic violence. They've got depression. They're separated from their children. There's a lot of issues that we deal with there. Further, it seems that women are just more likely to seek help than men are. And so they do get, as a group, a higher level of psychological and psychiatric help. When we prepare those individuals, whether it's men or women, for release, we do try to transition into the community, make contacts for them in the community with psychological care, psychiatric care. If they're on medications, we give them a prescription for a month's worth of meds, and then we set them up with their first appointment out there on the streets. And that's part of this transition to from prison to community model that Commissioner Bray was speaking of. We also have release planners who work specifically with the seriously and persistently mentally ill offenders, and we provide just a little bit more planning and care and through the process of getting those individuals out on the streets, because it is so important to public safety that there is continuity in their care.
Mr. Chair.
Mayor Lantz.
If I may follow up on the chemical dependency question. On the chart, the chart that you have here, or the statement that you have here, 804 beds, of the 2,900 offenders assessed need for chemical dependency treatment, are those who have been deemed addicted, or does that include those who abused chemicals that came into prison?
We try to prioritize those offenders who are addicted and have the greatest need, but it does include perhaps some offenders that are abusing chemicals as well.
Mr. Chairman, the
Senator Lantz.
Commissioners, but the 2,900 number is mostly those who are dependent, who are addicted?
Those are
Commissioner Chris.
All offenders who are assessed. It includes both.
Mr. Chairman, maybe I can get some help down the road. I'm trying to determine how much this underreports the need for some kind of chemical treatment, use or abuse or dependency treatment. You know, there's a whole variety, a range of treatment intensities that are available within the, probably within prison, but more so within the community, from inpatient treatment to outpatient treatment. With several different levels of length of time and intensity and programming and so on, which, you know, professionals will assess individuals what level they think are needed and whether it's true alcohol dependency, for example, or if it's occasional abuse or whatever the situation is. And so I'm trying to determine, do those 804 beds, is that only 28% of those who are really addicted that are getting treated, and there are many more who are not addicted in the classic sense but still have chemical use problems that are not even addressed or nearly as well addressed even in those 804 beds? Because I suspect if we're looking to save money in the system, we could do a lot to reduce recidivism if we doubled or tripled our beds for treatment in prison, and you'd see the cost savings in number of beds needed for reincarceration down the road pretty quickly.
Yeah. Senator Lantz, this is an interesting area. We don't have a lot of time today to continue going into this much detail, but if the department could perhaps hear some of the concerns raised by Senator Lantz, I'm sure we're all interested in maybe reviewing this subject a little later in the session. Commissioner Bray the last question, and that is, you brought up current federal grants. Do we have any one-time grants that you're enjoying now that will now come to an end? And do you know roughly what that dollar amount would be?
Throughout the department, we have a whole host of grants. And I'm thinking perhaps the best thing we can do, unless one of my colleagues know off the top of their head, we have a breakout of every grant, when we got it, when it ends, and a total dollar amount. I'd be happy to get that to you.
Commissioner, that'll be important for us as we sum up our budget recommendations toward the end of the year, so that'll be key to some of our consideration. We're going to move on to civil legal services. Thank you, Commissioners, for your report.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members.
Civil Legal Services will be represented by Gary Hurd and Jerry Lane. Mr. Hurd?
Good afternoon,
Mr. Chairman. Anytime you're ready.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, Leader Latz, Senators, committee staff. Thank you for the opportunity to meet with you today to discuss the role of Civil Legal Services in helping the state of Minnesota meet its constitutional obligation to provide access to justice. My name is Gary Hurd. I'm the Chief Operating Officer for Southern Minnesota Regional Legal Services. And joining me today to help address any questions you may have is Jerry Lane, Executive Director of Mid-Minnesota Legal Assistance. Together, our program service areas contain approximately 70% of the state's poverty population. We are here today representing the Minnesota Legal Services Coalition and to speak to the impact of the civil legal services component of the Supreme Court budget. By way of an overview, our presentation will cover the following topics: the real life impact of civil legal services, the need for civil legal services, an overview of our service structure and funding, an assessment of the impact of the justice system funding crisis on civil legal services, and a summary of our 2012-13 appropriation request. Your committee packets include a handout of a PowerPoint presentation that summarizes the points I will be covering in my remarks. Additional information about civil legal services is also included in your packets. One of the largest areas of demand for our service is in family law, and a major focus of our family law work is assisting victims of domestic violence. Civil legal services breaks the cycle of domestic violence for many families. It helps them restructure their lives, create safety and stability for their children, and increase the chances of breaking the family's cycle of poverty. Research has shown that the availability of civil legal services is one of only two statistically significant factors in reducing local rates and the resulting harm of domestic violence. Additionally, you should know that legal aid played an important role in helping to develop a tool that is now in extended use in courtrooms throughout the state to help judges assess lethality in domestic violence cases. In the homelessness area, this legislature passed a series of protections for homeowners facing foreclosure. Our work helped Tammy obtain the benefits of those protections and stopped an equity skimming company from unlawfully taking the home in which she and her children had lived for 15 years. The workout provided an affordable way for the family to keep their home. Civil Legal Services prevents homelessness for thousands of families each year by obtaining needed repairs, helping eligible families access public or subsidized housing, and by helping families respond to the mortgage foreclosure crisis. These services save approximately $4 million annually in tax-supported shelter costs and by preventing homelessness in over 2,650 cases. Studies show that civil legal services help reduce local crime and school truancy by reducing the impact of homelessness, particularly for youth. Dolores is 74 years old and is wheelchair-bound. She relies on home health services to stay in the home she has lived in for 40 years. When the county unreasonably cut the number of hours of home health care to which she was entitled, she was faced with having to move to a nursing home. We appealed the county's decision and obtained a restoration of Dolores' home health services, preventing an unnecessary move to a more expensive and less comfortable nursing facility. Civil Legal Services helps people with disabilities, seniors, and families needing education and training to make the transition from welfare to work. Our services secure $5 million annually in new federal disability benefits for Minnesotans that produces a cumulative economic impact of $275 million over 10 years. Civil legal services, along with the courts and public defenders, are an essential element of Minnesota's justice system and a core government service. Just as the public defenders protect access to justice for those with limited means facing criminal charges, legal aid extends similar access to justice for those who are dealing with civil matters but cannot afford legal assistance on their own. The courts and other parts of the justice system work best for all Minnesotans when legal aid and public defender services are there to assure that all have access. Or as observed by Chief Justice Gilday, the justice system is an ecosystem in which all parts contribute to the vitality of the whole. I want to draw your attention to two specific needs that civil legal services satisfies. One systemic and the other unique to these times of economic crisis. Civil legal services is, in some respects, an efficiency program within the justice system. Consider this question. What if civil legal services were not already a part of Minnesota's justice system and the courts were asked to take measures to become more efficient? What system would the court need to screen out non-meritorious cases, to settle thousands of cases that could be resolved without the need for court intervention, and to educate and counsel people to help them resolve their problems or to prevent them from getting into legal problems in the first place? If civil legal services were not already a part of Minnesota's justice system, the courts would need to create the system we have today to become more efficient. Legal aid reduces the number of cases with unrepresented parties appearing in court, a valuable time saver in the courtroom. We also relieve burdens on the courts by keeping over 3,000 cases annually from finding their way into the courtroom. Our ability to work with clients to find alternatives to resolving civil legal disputes reduces court costs by approximately $5 million annually. Civil legal services provides a needed efficiency in our justice system. But civil legal services is also needed to help Minnesotans, especially now. The recession produced a 40% increase in requests for services from legal aid agencies in Minnesota. The simple fact is that our services are countercyclical. The need for civil legal services increases during times of economic downturns. And many of those new people coming through our doors seeking help to cope with the recession's impact are people who did not expect to ever need or even to qualify for legal aid services. Civil legal services helps families facing job loss, personal finance and credit crisis, loss of housing or mortgage foreclosure, need for emergency assistance, or a threat of domestic violence. In short, in addition to responding to need for access and efficiency in our justice system, civil legal services meets a need to help Minnesotans achieve economic recovery. Minnesota Legal Services Coalition is a statewide resource. It's comprised of the 7 regional legal assistance agencies that are members of the Minnesota Legal Services Coalition and who deliver services in every county in the state, as well as an additional 24 community and special practice programs. Together, we share the mission of assuring access to open, affordable, and understandable services to all Minnesotans, regardless of income. We provide direct legal assistance to Minnesota families by handling approximately 52,900 cases annually. We also provide legal education and preventive services to approximately 70,000 Minnesotans. And our websites receive over 500,000 hits every year seeking legal education materials. Total funding for civil legal services in Minnesota is approximately $34 million annually. This includes a combination of private donations, federal funds, and state funds. The state funds are administered through the Legal Services Advisory Committee, which is a committee appointed by the Supreme Court. By statute, 85% of the funding in the appropriation is distributed by on a poverty population basis to the regional legal services programs, with the remaining 15% of the funds awarded on a competitive basis to community and special purpose programs. LSAC is responsible for allocating resources made available for civil legal services through the three-legged stool of state support, comprised of the state general fund appropriation, the funds from the IOLTA, or Interest on Lawyers Trust Account Program, and the funds from the attorney registration fee, which comes from attorneys' licenses. The general fund support for civil legal services is $11.815 million per year in this fiscal year. That is the projected amount for the biennium of 2012-13. However, this amount is down approximately 11% from the $13.3 million appropriation in 2008. And the decline has made civil legal services the only part of Minnesota's justice system that is funded below 2006 levels. The IOLTA program has had has been a significant source for state administered funding for legal services since it was started in 1984. However, due to the recession-induced interest rates, IOLTA revenue has declined 80% over the past 3 years, from $3.8 million annually to approximately $500,000 annually. Reserves in the account have cushioned the blow for this current biennium, but those funds have been depleted. And so the amount available for grants in this coming biennium is approximately 69% lower than it was. Last year, the Supreme Court temporarily increased the attorney registration fee, designating $25 of additional funding toward legal services. The court sunsetted this provision in July of 2011. We have currently petitioned to renew the funding, but there is approximately $600,000 of our funding that is at risk in that decision. So in summary, the state funding has dropped approximately 19%, is scheduled to drop 19% from this current biennium to next biennium, even if the state appropriation remains the same. In testimony to this committee last week, you learned that the Supreme Court is staffed at 86% of need and the public defenders at 56% of need. By way of comparison, according to the Federal Legal Services Corporation Documenting the Justice Gap in America report, funding for civil legal services in Minnesota meets only about 50% of the need. For every client who receives legal services, one eligible applicant has to be turned away for lack of resources. Faced with steep declines in funding of various sorts since the early 80s, civil legal services agencies in Minnesota have been redesigning services to achieve efficiencies well before the state entered its current cycle of budget challenges. We've had to deal with inadequate funding for a very long time, and operating economically and efficiently is a way of doing business in legal aid. Continually evaluating and improving our systems for delivering services is ongoing integrated part of how civil legal services does its work. We've introduced a rural intake hotline to help outstate residents access our services. We've worked with the courts to develop an order for protection application process to provide consistent paperwork with which judges are familiar. We've used websites to provide legal resources to over 500,000 requests per year. And we are currently piloting an online application process to further increase access to our services. We have reallocated resources to limit the focus of our work to just crisis needs. We have integrated technology improvements to ease access to service and improve efficiencies of internal systems. We found ways to keep costs low by collaborating on training for our staff and other professionals who help us meet our clients' needs. And perhaps most importantly, we have benefited from the high quality high-value services provided by a motivated workforce and committed volunteers, a workforce that delivers results even though their salaries are the lowest in the justice system. In 2009, Civil Legal Services program staff provided extended representation to approximately 9,900 Minnesotans. This is a 9.8% drop in extended representation from 2007 to 2009 and corresponds in the reduction to Civil Legal Services attorney positions due to general fund budget reductions during the same period. In other words, we're serving approximately the same number of clients, 52,900, but more of them are getting advice and brief service, and fewer are getting the kind of service that is most effective in meeting their legal needs. We have submitted a flat funding request for this biennium, but this is not a hold harmless request. It does not seek to restore budget reductions and staff losses from previous years. It does not seek a general fund remedy to help us manage the anticipated $3.4 million loss in state-administered IOLTA funds. It does not seek to resolve the uncertainty about the $600,000 in annual revenue that comes from the attorney registration fees. What we request is to stop the multi-year trend of reducing the general fund appropriation for legal services. We seek a general fund appropriation of $23.63 million for the biennium, the amount that was budgeted for the 2012-13 TALES as part of last year's supplemental budget adjustment. In closing, I'd like to acknowledge the history of bipartisan support within the legislature, both for the justice system and the role of civil legal services. Justice is not a partisan issue. I also want to acknowledge the leadership of Chief Justice Gilday and our partners in the Coalition to Preserve Minnesota's Justice System, the Minnesota Courts, the Public Defenders, the Prosecutors, the State Bar Association, law enforcement, and others, who share our commitment to having a justice system that is viable and protects access to justice for all of our state citizens. And Mr. Chairman and members of the committee, I thank you for the responsive consideration you have given to Minnesota's need for a justice system that is truly capable of serving all of the citizens of the state. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Hurd. Was Mr. Lane going to give a presentation also?
Mr. Chairman, thank you for the opportunity, but I thought Gary was eloquent and complete, and I'll stop talking.
All right. Does anyone have any questions for civil legal? Yes, Senator Newman.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Mr. Hurd, in your opening remarks, you made reference to a constitutional obligation to provide civil legal services. Specifically, what were you referring to?
Mr. Chairman.
Mr. Hurd.
Senator Newman, I said that the state is obligated to provide access to the justice system. Civil legal services helps provide that access to low-income Minnesotans.
Thank you, Mr. Hurd.
Thank you. Senator Ingebrigtsen.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Real quickly, with regards to your funding sources, you said you had received some grants from the feds and from here and from there. Could you be a little more specific? And I guess what I'm looking at is I see we also service at least three of the tribes that I'm seeing here. What type of services do you provide there? And are there any revenue sources there at all? Maybe you could cover that.
Mr. Hurd.
Mr. Chairman, Senator Ingebrigtsen. Five of the regional programs receive funding from the federal government from the Legal Services Corporation, or LSC. Other programs receive various grants from the Department of Justice or from the Department of Housing and Urban Development for various legal work. I don't have the numbers to tell you exactly what that amount is. It's like a constantly changing picture. And as far as the Native American programs, there is one of the regional programs, Anishinaabe Legal Services, that provides services on the three reservations in northern Minnesota. Their federal funding comes from legal services and part of the Legal Services Corporation charge is to provide services on Native American reservations.
Mr. Chairman?
Yes, Mr. Lang.
Just to supplement that answer, Senator, the federal funding for legal services has approximately 50% of the purchasing power it had 25 years ago. Of course, the federal government is facing hard times like every other level of government, and so there's no realistic expectation of recapturing much of, if any of that lost ground. With regard to Native American services, my program for some years did have a contract with the Mille Lacs Band of Ojibwe. A couple of years ago, the band decided to bring that service, both their public defense and their civil legal services programs, in-house, so they provide that service on the reservation in the Mille Lacs area at their own expense.
Thank you.
Members, we'll be having civil legal services come before the committee in other times during this session, especially when we get closer to budget making. And I'm going to move us off this subject now and move us to Sentencing Guidelines Commission. We have limited time left, and we have to keep rolling.
Thank you, gentlemen.
Sir. Welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Mr. Edblad?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Members of the committee, good afternoon, and thank you for having us here this afternoon. My name is Jeff Edblad. I am the Isanti County Attorney and Chair of the Minnesota Sentencing Guidelines Commission. With me is Interim Executive Director Jill Payne. This afternoon, I'll be providing you with a brief overview of the Minnesota Sentencing Guidelines and its commission, and with the Chair's permission, Ms. Payne will then give a brief overview of the agency itself. Minnesota created the country's first Sentencing Guidelines Commission by an act of the legislature in 1978 for crimes effective on or after May 1st of 1980. A sentencing guidelines system provides the legislature with a structure for determining and maintaining a rational sentencing policy. Through the development of the sentencing guidelines, the legislature determines what will be the goals and purposes of the state's sentencing system. The guidelines generally represent the goals of the criminal justice system, and they specifically recommend the appropriate sentence for an individual based upon offense severity and the offender's criminal history. And it's important to note for the committee that a majority, or 74.9%, of felony offenders in the state of Minnesota get the recommended guideline sentence when sentenced by the court. Also, I want to note for the committee that the guidelines do not apply to first-degree murder cases and certain criminal sexual conduct offenses that carry mandatory life imprisonment sentences. In looking at the sentencing guidelines grid structure, the vertical axis on the grid represents the severity level of offenses, ranging in the lowest severity level at a severity level 1 to the highest severity of a severity 11, 11 again being the most severe. On the horizontal axis of the grid is the offender's criminal history, including prior record, prior felony offenses, certain amount of prior targeted misdemeanor offenses, certain targeted juvenile offenses, as well as custody status, or if the person is on supervision to the Department of Corrections at the time of the commission of the offense. Note that each cell has a recommended duration, and in looking at the grid, you'll see the black line running through the grid, which is the dispositional line. And with each cell having a recommended duration, it is this dispositional line that distinguishes the offenses from probation to prison. Anything below the big black line in the gray squares is a presumptive probationary sentence. Anything above the big black line in the white boxes is a presumptive prison sentence, with the duration of that sentence noted in the grid. In 2006, the Minnesota Sentencing Guidelines Commission did create a second grid or a separate sex offender grid to recognize the unique nature of sex offenses. And I will note that attempted first-degree murder has its own separate sentencing grid as well. The Minnesota Sentencing Guidelines Commission is an 11-member body created by the legislature. Out of those 11 people, 8 are appointed by the governor. We are currently in transition, awaiting Governor Dayton's 8 appointments to the Minnesota Sentencing Guidelines Commission. The remaining 3 are appointed by the Chief Justice of the Minnesota Supreme Court. The 3 judges appointed by the Chief Justice represent the 3 levels of courts in the state of Minnesota, one from the District Court, one from the Court of Appeals, one from the Supreme Court. By statute, the Commissioner of Corrections is an automatic member. The statute further allows for gubernatorial appointment of a licensed peace officer, a county attorney, a public defender, a probation officer, and 3 citizens, one of which must be the victim of a violent crime. As I had stated, we are currently in transition, awaiting the appointments of Governor Dayton to the commission. The Minnesota Sentencing Guidelines Commission maintains and modifies the sentencing guidelines that govern felony sentences in the state in order to support Minnesota sentencing goals. And those goals include the following. 1, to better assure public safety. 2, to promote uniformity in sentencing so that offenders who are convicted of similar crimes that have similar criminal history records are sentenced similarly. 2, provide truth and certainty in sentencing. And when we talk about truth and certainty in sentencing, determinate sentencing means that offenders actually receive the amount of time as pronounced at the time of sentencing. Also, a goal of the Minnesota Sentencing Guidelines is to establish proportionality in sentencing by emphasizing the concept of just deserts, or a not soft on crime, or a make sure the individual is punished fairly approach or philosophy, where the punishment does fit the crime. First-time offenders convicted of violent offenses and those with more extensive nonviolent criminal records are the individuals who the prison sentences are recommended for. In looking at the history of the Minnesota sentencing guidelines, the number of felons sentenced over time has gone up considerably. In 1981, or when I was a freshman in college, there were 5,500 felons sentenced, compared to 2009, when my son started his freshman year, where there were 14,840 felons sentenced, or a change from 1981 to 2009 of 170%. Also during this time, the guidelines have become more complex, and we have seen sentence lengths increased. One noticeable enhancement that is not listed in your materials is a result of the felony domestic assault offense that was created by the legislature in 2006. And this offense is up 371% since 2006, due in part to a broader statutory definition, creating the need ultimately for 324 prison beds and 161 jail beds. However, overall, Minnesota does continue to experience an overall decrease in the number of felons sentenced, beginning in 2007 with 16,168 felons sentenced. There were 14,840 felony offenders sentenced in 2009, which was a 3.6% decrease from the 15,394 sentenced the year before in 2008. And just a side note, 90.8% of all felony offenders get pronounced incarceration in either a state prison or a county jail facility. The downward trend in felony convictions and sentences appears to be a result of the decline in both the number of felony DWI offenders sentenced, as well as the number of drug offenders sentenced, specifically the methamphetamine-related offenders. The only crime category that has exhibited growth is the area of crimes against a person, and that has been a growth at the rate of 6% with much of that growth coming from domestic assault-related offenses as well as various first-degree assaults. The National Center for State Courts released a report in 2008 entitled Assessing Consistency and Fairness in Sentencing, a Comparative Study in Three States. And the comparison was the National Center for State Courts taking a look at the guideline structures in Minnesota, in Michigan, and in Virginia. And this 2008 study found that Minnesota's guidelines offer higher predictability due to the compact set of elements used to determine criminal history, as well as comparatively narrow guideline ranges. The report also indicated that guidelines make sentencing more transparent and limited undesirable sentencing disparity by reducing factors such as race and economic status from the sentencing equation. You have heard some testimony earlier with regard to incarceration rates by comparison. The low incarceration rates reflect one of the key principles of the sentencing guidelines because, as we're all aware, correctional facilities are finite and sanctions used in sentencing convicted felons should be the least restrictive necessary to achieve the purposes of sentencing. In 2008, there was a 2008 comparison. The Bureau of Justice Statistics determined that Minnesota's incarceration rate was second lowest of all states in the nation, with only Maine being lower. The rate that was determined by that study was an amount of 179 individuals incarcerated in Minnesota per 100,000 residents. As I had mentioned, Maine had a lower rate of 151 incarcerated per 100,000 residents. And in comparison, the state of Louisiana had the highest incarceration rate at 853 individuals per 100,000 residents. A major responsibility of the Minnesota Sentencing Guidelines Commission is to maintain the guideline structure by annually modifying the sentencing guidelines. In 2010, the commission responded to legislative changes and addressed legislative changes through various new crime legislation that was introduced and passed by the legislature, including expanding the identity theft statute, where the expansion of that statute caused the need to re-rank that at a severity level 2, as well as raising the severity level for possession of a dangerous weapon on school property from a severity level 1 to a severity level 4 offense. The Guidelines Commission in 2010 also responded to new case law from the Minnesota Supreme Court or the Minnesota Court of Appeals addressing sentencing issues and sentencing guidelines. And we also dealt with issues raised by concerned parties. An example of concerned parties was in 2009, the Minnesota Sentencing Guidelines Commission moved prostitution offenses to the sex offender grid, will be effective as of August 2011, based upon concerns that were brought to us by victim groups and law enforcement groups. Also in 2010, the Minnesota Sentencing Commission, Guidelines Commission, did meet 5 times as a body, and we held 1 public hearing. Now, Mr. Chair, with your permission, I would turn the presentation over to our interim director, Jill Payne.
Thank you, Mr. Edblad. Before we begin, members, we'll be extending our time for about 10-15 minutes today. We got a little long on one of our presentations, but sentencing guidelines is one of those important areas that we have to stay focused on when we consider other bills. So,
Mr. Chairman?
Yes.
Mr. Chairman, I don't want to prolong anything, but I think you ought to consider maybe if we're looking for more time to perhaps do extend that and make it, so then people can arrange their schedule.
All right.
Accordingly. I mean, it's fine with me if the meeting goes a little longer. Heaven knows I've sat in a Judiciary Committee meeting that lasted longer than an hour and a half. I don't think I ever sat in one that lasted just an hour and a half. So.
Thank you, Senator Scheid. It is difficult with the confines of our time that we've been given, and yet we do have the room available to us. I was speaking to our staff just the other day, last week, about considering that very same thing. So thank you. Ms. Payne.
Thank you, Mr.
Welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. My name is Jill Payne. I'm the Interim Executive Director for the Sentencing Guidelines Commission. My comments will be brief. I will just describe to you the commission staff and what we do and give a few examples of what we've done in the last year. We have six staff members. The executive director works closely with the commission and with the legislature. We have a management analyst who does the majority of our outreach and training and also manages the office. We have four research staff who manage the databases and the data themselves. Our agency gains efficiencies by receiving services in human resources and finance from the Department of Corrections. On slide 13 and 14, I'm giving examples of what the staff has done in the past year. In 2010, as was mentioned, we collected sentencing information for all felons who were sentenced in 2009. That's nearly 15,000 records. After we collect those, we review them for accuracy, guidelines application, and we determine whether or not there's been a departure in the case. We provided training for over 500 practitioners throughout the state, including judges, probation officers, and attorneys. We responded to 100 data requests. Those requests came from attorneys, the media, academics, other states who are interested in Minnesota sentencing structure. We answered 2,500 sentencing guidelines-related phone call inquiries. These calls came from probation officers, judges, attorneys, victims, and offenders. We prepared 28 fiscal note requests from the legislature. We did this within time constraints, often having only a few days to return them to you. And I'll also note that beginning in 2006, our commission began providing racial impact notes to the legislature on any proposed crime bill when a disparate impact was anticipated. We were the first to do that in the nation, and now Iowa and Connecticut have enacted laws to do the same. Continuing on page 14, we collaborated with the Department of Corrections on generating the prison bed projections, and they described that a little bit earlier today, but I'll make a note that in a report released in January, the projected versus the actual prison bed population was off by only 29 offenders, and that's 0.3%. We served on various boards, forums, and committees, including the Supreme Court's Racial Fairness Subcommittee on Drug Offenses and the Drug Court Evaluation Committee. We distributed sentencing guidelines and annual reports, sending electronic reports of the guidelines to all probation officers in all 87 counties. We made additional reports available on our website as well. In 2010, our agency reduced operating expenses, which I'll talk about in just a moment. And we also found new ways to use technology. Namely, our agency worked with the state courts and collaborated on implementing a new way to receive the sentencing data from the MNSIS state court's information system. That technology saved us countless manual hours of collecting data, and the project was accomplished within our existing budget and within the state court's budget. On page 15, you'll see our biennial budget from the last biennium was $1.12 million. The majority of that is for staffing. 15% is for operating expenses. On page 16, you'll see our biennial budget over time. It was reduced by 8% from fiscal year 08-09. And on page 17, in fiscal year 10 and 11, our commission cut one position, and we reduced our operating expenses, as I mentioned. Our agency moved to a state-owned building that reduced our rent by over one-third. We gained efficiencies in this move as well. we switched to Office of Enterprise Technology desktop support, which reduced our research staff's need to spend time on IT-related functions, leaving more time to focus on our core functions. We reduced in-state travel by holding more webinars, expanding training materials available on our website, and providing more reports online versus producing printed materials. In closing, I'll say that our new, now reduced staff is able to meet the current demands and fulfill its core functions, but we would become overextended very quickly if we were reduced any further. Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Payne. Are there any questions? Yes, Senator Goodman.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I was going to call you Mr. Speaker for a second.
I used to be in the House.
I do have a couple. One thing is, unfortunately, I can't read most of your charts in here because they're really tiny, and I asked my seatmate if he could read it. It would be really helpful to have that clarified, these charts clarified, so that we can read them. And also, I mean, even this donut in here on page 15 is 15%, 85%, but it's all the same color. So it's not very readable. And for those of us that haven't served on judiciary before, it would be very helpful. The other thing is I just have to ask this question. And I'm seeing that, you know, you're spending over $1 million on 6 staff people. Is that correct? Or is that including stipends for the commissioners? Or how does that work?
Ms. Payne?
Mr. Chair, Senator Goodwin, that is a biennial figure. So that's for a 2-year period.
Okay, thank you.
If that helps at all.
That does.
Thank you.
Senator Engelbert.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And on that note of funding, could you give me an idea, two questions here. If you can give me an idea as to your growth of staff. You've been in the business now for 33 years, 1978, you said. Can you give me an idea what you started with, what the sentencing guidelines started with back then and where you are now?
Ms. Payne.
Mr. Limmer, Senator Ingebrigtsen. This predates me a little bit, but from what I understand, the staff began with about 3 people once after the legislature enacted the commission. It continued to be about 3 staff members, but a lot of the data entry was very manual and was outsourced, so there was manual work that was done not by the staff. We peaked with about, I believe at one time we had 8 staff members, and now we've been reduced down to 6.
Thank you. And my second question would be
Senator
to
Ingebrigtsen.
The county attorney would be, we're talking about being 49th in numbers on our charts here as far as sentencing. Prisoners being sentenced. Can you give me a ranking on what the average stay of length in Minnesota is versus the rest of the states?
Mr. Chair, Senator, I believe Ms. Payne has that information.
Mr. Chair,
Ms.
Senator
Payne.
Ingebrigtsen, the average prison sentence in Minnesota is 50 months.
15.
Senator Ingebrigtsen. Yes.
Thank you. Do you have a ranking there with other states? Are we sentencing our folks longer than other states general?
Mr. Chair, Senator Ingebrigtsen, I apologize, but I don't have that figure on hand, but I'm certain I can find that for you. I'd be happy to do that.
Senator Scheid.
Yes, thank you, Mr. Chairman. I've served on this committee now just for 4 years, and I don't recall proposals or bills coming before us, you know, that were generated by the Sentencing Guidelines Commission. That doesn't mean you didn't. I'm not recalling them. But we did have some rather lengthy discussion, but we had severe time constraints last session in 2010 concerning sex offenders and perhaps reworking the sentencing there. The governor's initiative was, I think, to double. I think it was to double. Mm-hmm. CrimSex 1, but I think that was the only change in legislation that, or a change in sentencing, and that was what the bill was. And the Senate committee talked about that at some length, about reworking the different degrees and looking at crimes in there that might have longer sentences rather than having people end up in the sex offender program. We think there's a cost savings, and I wondered if you had been involved in any of that, not just across the board. It's much more complex than that, and it will take time. But, Mr. Chairman, I think you recall the conversations, right?
Yeah. Senator Scheid, you're correct in your observation. Sentencing Guidelines Commission hasn't really been an active participant, let's say, for lack of a better word, in our discussions for a great number of years. There was a time about 10 years back when there was a flurry of increased sentencing proposals, and they were active at that time. They were used as to give advice to the legislature at that time, at least to determine the proportionality of sentences as a legislature began to explore the possibility of expanding sentencing. I do remember there was discussion regarding some of the governor proposals last year or 2 years ago, and I don't think it ever really came to full fruition, and so we're kind of on a hold right now on that issue.
Mr. Chairman.
Senator Scheid.
Mr. Chairman, if I might, I would like to ask people if you've given that thought, or if you've looked at that or had those discussions, and if you have, I think it would be helpful to share that with us,
mm-hmm.
Because I think it has a whole lot of sense to it from my perspective.
Right.
But we just didn't have time. It was just last year. It was in 2010,
yeah.
And we really just didn't have time to get through analyzing all of the different degrees and the subsets within that. So I wonder if you can respond, if you've had any conversations about that.
Ms. Payne?
Mr. Chair, Senator Scheid, last year there were bills introduced that asked to increase the the presumptive sentence for first-degree criminal sexual conduct, changing it from 12 years to 25 years. That did not pass. We have actually received a fiscal note request out of the House on that same type of legislation for this session. I will say last session, after the session, there was a working group that met during the summer that was from the Department of Human Services, I believe, that was looking at various parts of the issue with sex offenders. One of those components was related to sentencing sex offenders, and one of our commission members actually served on that committee. Now, I know that there has been a report released, and I do not know the title of it offhand. I apologize. But there was some work done on it over the summer, and I don't believe that there was any conclusion regarding the sentencing component.
Mr. Chairman.
Senator Scheid.
Mr. Chairman, I apologize for taking up too much time here, but I'm wondering, it didn't pass. I was the chief author in the Senate of that bill, and no, it didn't pass, but we also made substantial changes in the committee to that. And you know, Mr. Backus worked hard on that, but it's really an awesome, challenge to work your way through it, and I just wondered, I hope you're ready to do some of that or to give some thought to that. And members, and probably everybody in here knows, and I probably don't need to be teaching anybody anything, but what we have are situations where people are sentenced and for a shorter time, but we feel that they're still a threat, and they're ending up in the very expensive sex offender program. And so, civil commitment, and so through civil commitment. And so, there might be some rationale for increasing some of those sentences, not across the board, as I said, but for increasing some of them from the get-go so that we don't have that ending up burdening, which I, what I think is probably unsustainable. But
yeah. Senator Scheid, money is always the next thing to talk about whenever we discuss or consider longer sentences. And yet at the same time, it isn't an immediate cost. It would be at when the sentence is extended beyond what it is now, that's when we start triggering those tail effects on our budget. Senator Ingridson and then Senator Marty.
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chair. And to her point, I'm working on that right now. I might have been the one that requested that fiscal sheet along with the House member, but I'd be more than happy to work with you on that. And quite frankly, actually the opposite, Senator Limmer, I think in the tail years we're finding that that's when we start showing the savings instead of the other way. So that's something I'll talk to you about.
Okay. Senator Marty.
Mr. Chairman, on that point, I was just curious, who does Sentencing Guidelines Commission have the capability, because you don't deal with the sex offender program, does somebody have the ability to give fiscal notes that would intertwine sex offender programs with prison sentencing, or is that just something our staff tries to deal with because nobody really calculates? If you made this change in sentencing, it would reduce that change here. Is anybody capable of Guidelines Commission? Do you have any information on that, or is that something you're in the dark and just trying to pull things together too?
Ms. Payne, are you the one capable of answering Senator Marty's question?
Mr. Chair, Senator Marty, as part of the fiscal note request process, various agencies are asked to respond to their piece of the legislation. So in that respect, we would respond to the sentencing piece of it, and then possibly the Department of Human Services would be asked to respond to the component related to civil commitment.
Any other questions? We're beginning to understand just how complicated and intricate some of the issues in Judiciary Committee get with other committees. Hearing no other concern or no other issues, meeting adjourned.